In early Buddhism, instead of using the words expansion and contraction, they use the expression udaya vyaya. Udaya means rising, and vyaya means passing. And usually in the Vipassana tradition, which is the early Buddhist mindfulness tradition, that's how you describe the process of impermanence. You watch things rising and passing, rising and fading. What would be some other words that we could use? Affirmation, negation, life, death would be some possibilities. Why are there so many possible sets of synonyms? Well, because there are so many binary contrasting experiences that we encounter in this life, and we don't recognize that they're all reflections of the same pair of principles. Some of the synonyms that Sasaki Roshi uses might be shocking. Non sequiturs, like they don't compute at all. Because expansion he also calls outside, and contraction he calls inside. Maybe that doesn't make any sense, but think about it. What is it that pulls us out into space? It's an expansive principle. We look over there, it expands. We look over there, it expands out. We look back into our memories, something that was big has gotten small. We're looking back into contraction on the inside. He calls expansion future, what's about to happen, what's looming. He calls contraction past, what has happened, what has shrunk. Whenever we feel pulled to see an outside world, if instead of fixating on the outside world, we just pay attention to the pull, we'll see that outside is actually an expansive force. And whenever we are called to consider what's going to happen next, the future, you'll see that's a sort of pull of expansion. Whenever we have a sense of inside, instead of looking back at the thoughts and feelings that creates a sense of self on the inside, a sense of subjective, if we look just beyond that, we can feel an inward tug, a sort of center of gravity, called past or inside. It takes a long time for one to realize that these are really synonyms, that they really have any connection at all. And when we encounter that which affirms, that which allows, that which opens, we say, good, we like that. That's the expansive side. And when we encounter that which negates, that which limits, that which closes, we say, that's bad, I don't like that. That's our fundamental error, according to Sasaki Roshi. We don't realize that that which limits, that which closes, is absolutely as good, absolutely as liberating, absolutely as blissful, absolutely as necessary, absolutely as powerful as that which opens, that which expands, that which allows. Because we human beings, through a learning process, develop a prejudice in favor of expansion and against contraction, we develop an alienation from contraction and a familiarity with expansion, we run into problems because the universe is not put together that way. So the whole trick in meditation is to understand that the reason things change is because these fundamental forces are present and interacting. And when we watch change, we are in fact making a relationship. That's the expression that Sasaki Roshi uses. We're learning to connect, to develop an intimacy, a familiarity with both of these sides of nature. Among the lists of synonyms, which is very shocking and off-putting and confusing to people, is expansion is God and contraction is the devil. Do you think that he's saying that contraction is bad when he says contraction is the devil? Not in the slightest. What he's saying is that what people call the devil, which is basically whatever gets in their way, is called the devil. We tend to demonize whatever gets in our way, you've probably noticed. He's saying that when you find yourself demonizing something, reflect. Reflect on what's really there. And you'll see that behind that demon mask is just one of the hands of God that you're failing to recognize, the limiting hand of God. But see, they don't explain it that way. You either figure it out or you wash out. That's the problem with Zen practice. They'll just say, this world is created by when God and the devil separate, and you must learn how to make a relationship with God and the devil at the same time. And you wonder, what the heck this guy's trying to say? And then hopefully it dawns on you gradually. What you call the devil is in fact just as liberating, just as important, just as essential, and just as, quote, good as what you call God, that which affirms. This basic philosophy that sees the activity of our source in terms of a pair of contrasting yet complementary doings is found all over the world in various forms. The most obvious example that comes to mind is, of course, the Taoist system of yin and yang. The Tao consists of two sides, an expansive affirming side called yang and a contractive negating side called yin. One is as good as the other. They're both absolutely necessary. They're both equally powerful. In my own vocabulary, I like to refer to systems like this as dyadic systems. Dyad in Greek means a pair, a duet. Dyadic systems as opposed to what? As opposed to dualistic systems. In dualistic systems, you've got a pair, but they're not contrasting and complementary. They are at war with each other, and your job is to take sides with one of them. The classic example of a dualistic system comes from Persia, Zoroastrianism, and just about everything that grows out of Persia is colored by this dualistic point of view. There's two gods, a good god called Ahura Mazda and a bad god called various names, Ahriman is one of them, and they're at war. And your job is to side with the good god. And the bad god is bad and must be eliminated. It is not a complementary kind of situation. When the Ayatollah Khomeini calls the United States the enemy of God, the devil, he's hearkening back to his pre-Islamic Zoroastrian dualistic roots. In point of fact, Islam picked up this kind of dualism from Judaism. And Judaism picked it up during the period of contact with Persian culture after the Jews were liberated from the Babylonian captivity by the Persians. They lived with the Persians, and they picked up this God versus the devil point of view that then got into Christianity and Islam. That's the historical origins of the Western devil. So the Western devil is very different from the Buddhist devil. Okay. The Buddhist devil is not the devil, okay? Buddhist devil is just the left hand of God, you might say. Another classical dualistic system that comes from the West, from Greco-Roman culture, is the dualism of spirit versus matter. Spirit is good, matter is bad. There was a whole movement called Gnosticism based on this. Other examples of dyadic systems that look upon the creating activity as having an expansive and contractive side can be found in ancient Greece. In fact, enantia, which in Greek means opposites or contrasting pairs, was a major theme of pre-Socratic Greek philosophy. Sometimes the contrast was described in terms of limiting versus limitless. The limitless would be the expansive, the limiting would be contractive. Pythagoras, who was one of the very important early philosophers and an early mathematician, felt that the entire universe was created by two forces. One, the force of non-limitation, and the other, the force of limitation. He was prejudiced in favor of the force of limitation. This is at the very base of the beginning of Western civilization. And he formed a whole brotherhood called the Pythagorean Brotherhood. And one of their main doctrines was reincarnation. That's where that idea first appeared in the West. This brotherhood was the first Western religion. Other early Greek philosophers, Anaximenes, talked about manosis and pygnosis. Manosis means a rarefaction, and pygnosis is a condensation. Once again, expansion and contraction. By far and away, the most fascinating of the early Greek philosophers from a Buddhist perspective is Heraclitus. Heraclitus was probably the first enlightened Westerner. I say probably because we only have fragments of his writings, so it's difficult to really be sure. He was called the Riddler. He was called the Enigmatic. He talked like a Zen master. He had a little bit of a strange personality that is reminiscent of a Zen master in my eyes. He's the one that said, you can't step in the same river twice, or at least according to Plato, he said that. He said, panta hre. Panta, all things, hre, flow. And therefore, the best description of reality is fire. And people think he was referring to the physical fire, but of course that's not what he was talking about. He was talking about impermanence. Anybody with Buddhist experience that reads Heraclitus finds themselves immediately in familiar territory. And then when you read the commentaries by the modern scholars and modern philosophers, their interpretation of Heraclitus, your heart sinks because you realize they don't have a clue as to what this guy was talking about. Not a clue. It's pure impermanence. The way he talks about it, it is so obvious what he was experiencing. He says, anybody that has wisdom will understand and proclaim that there is only one, with a capital O, okay? So he talks about the oneness, and he says that this world was not made by any man or any god, but was, is, and always will be eternal fire that wells up and subsides, that advances and recedes, that scatters and gathers. Sound familiar? And he lists a whole bunch of synonyms, just like my teacher, Sasaki Roshi. God is day, and God is also night. God is like a bow held by a string. God is both the bow and the string. What does it mean? The bow expands out, the string contracts in at exactly the same time. There is a hidden harmony to things, an interplay of expansive and contractive. He says God is both willing and unwilling to be called Zeus. If you look at the Sambhogakaya, you look at the world of the archetypes, you have God as Zeus, has a thunderbolt, is a man, has a beard, is in the sky. So God is willing to be called Zeus. God is Sambhogakaya, but God is also unwilling to be called Zeus because God is the Dharmakaya, the pure vibration, the pure activity that can only be described in terms of fire, because fire is that which never fixates. From that perspective, you can't call it Zeus, because it is the Dharmakaya, it's formless. It's a doing, not an entity. He even talks about how the activity of impermanence gets congealed and forms the sense of a material world. He says fire turns into water and water turns into earth. People thought he was talking about the material elements. Of course he wasn't. He was talking about the congealing process. And then earth turns back into water, water turns back into fire. He's talking about how when we experience things fully, we experience them in the vibratory mode, but then can actually see this world, this earth, this solidity coming out of that impermanence. It's really extraordinary. He's the major pre-Socratic philosopher. But in any event, it is rather fascinating that all over the world, one has these systems that look upon God or creation in terms of a pair of activities that in some way affirms and negates, in some way expands and contracts. A number of years ago, I had a student who was deeply into the Vipassana practice, but also deeply into his Jewish roots. And this, of course, is now a very prevalent phenomenon all over. In fact, there's been several books come out recently, and they deal with these themes. This was many, many years ago. What this student wanted me to do was meet his rabbi, which I was very interested in doing. And his rabbi was in the Lubavitcher Bodnik tradition. It's one of the schools of what they call Hasidim, or the pietist tradition, Judaism, as opposed to the legalist and academic tradition. The Hasidic tradition has many schools within it, but the Lubavitcher school, which is also called Chabad, they put a particular emphasis on the Kabbalistic aspect of Judaism. The Kabbalistic aspect of Judaism is the aspect of Judaism that deals with the intermediate realms of power, but also somewhat deals with the formless source of everything. Most people that get involved in Jewish Kabbalah get sidetracked into the realms of power, just like most people that get involved in spirituality get sidetracked into the realms of power. But there is, within the Kabbalistic tradition of Judaism, an absolute crystal clear formulation of the activity of impermanence, virtually identical to that which is found in Buddhism. It seems to be a parallel development, and therefore to point to something truly universal. The people that follow that Chabad version of Orthodox Judaism, they study the Kabbalah and they study the Tanya, which is an important commentary on the Kabbalah. We arranged to have lunch with this rabbi. We met at this kosher vegetarian restaurant. And then we started to talk and sort of compare notes. And I tried to elicit from him the technical vocabulary of Jewish meditation as he understood it. And it was fascinating. It was just absolutely fascinating. The Hebrew word for meditation, hitbonenut, is exactly what vipassana means. It means to carefully observe and make discriminations over and over again intensely. But what was the most interesting thing was I asked him to describe what would be the ultimate experience according to his tradition, and what would be the terminology in Hebrew to describe the ultimate experience. And he said, well, what we hope to achieve, but very few of us ever will, but what we're aiming at is to understand and to be able to experience in daily life Bri'ah Yesh Me'ayin. That's the Hebrew phrase. What does it mean? Bri'ah, the creation, yesh, of things and selves. Yesh means a thing and a self is a yesh. It's a sort of an existence. Meh, from, ayin, a very special kind of ayin. Ayin means nothing. N-O-T-H-I-N-G. Ayin is a synonym for God in mystical Judaism. Just like nihil is a synonym for God in medieval Europe. Nihil is the Latin for nothing. Just like shunyata is a synonym for God in Buddhism. Shunyata means nothing. Very special kind of nothing. Shunya also means the number zero. We'll be getting back to that in just a minute. Shunya also means the number zero. We'll be getting back to that in just a minute. So the pinnacle in the Jewish mystical tradition is to experience Bri'ah Yesh Me'ayin, which he translated as continuous creation, how things pour out of God, which is a spiritual nothing, moment by moment. And how does one come to this experience? One comes to this experience by being willing to participate in Bitul Hayesh, Bitul, the annihilation, Hayesh, of somethingness, of ego within one. You know how the Jewish people pray by rocking back and forth? That motion is supposed to represent a giving of yourself back to the flow of impermanence so that the sense of somethingness gets washed away. It's supposed to represent the expansion and contraction, and you become pliant like a flame that can just be blown in any direction without any rigidity within you. That's why they move that way, at least according to the mystical interpretation. And that's called Bitul Hayesh, the annihilation of the rigidity of the somethingness inside of your senses. And if you're willing to do that, then you can have a direct experience of how God works. And how does this ayin, how does this God create? There's a diagram that describes it, and that diagram is called the Chaim, or the Tree of Life. And if you look at it, it's bilaterally symmetrical. And the creation process zigzags from right to left, right to left, right to left, from nothing, ultimately culminating in something. So it vibrates back and forth. It starts at the nothing, and at the bottom, you've got self and world, the something. And what does it vibrate back and forth between? The two sides of God, which are called Chesed and Gvura. Chesed is the allowing side, and Gvura is the limiting side. So once again, the two fundamental principles. So all over the world, we can actually see dyadic models like this. Describing impermanence in terms of the two principles of expansion and contraction was not the way the Buddha himself taught. This paradigm, as far as I know, was developed by my present teacher, Josho Sasaki Roshi. Although, when you look carefully at the world mystical tradition, you can see that it is implicit in an awful lot of the previous writers and expositors of meditation, but only implicit, not explicit. In early Buddhism, instead of using the words expansion and contraction, they use the expression udaya vyaya. Udaya means rising, and vyaya means passing. And usually in the Vipassana tradition, which is the early Buddhist mindfulness tradition, that's how you describe the process of impermanence. You watch things rising and passing, rising and fading. Of course, when we talk about the process of impermanence as the process of creation, it's important to bear in mind that what we're describing is the subjective process of consciousness. In other words, the meditator has taken the microscope of mindfulness and directed it towards the flow of experience, and over time come up with a model or paradigm for how consciousness works moment by moment. It's like taking a physical microscope. One looks at the external world through that physical microscope, and not immediately, but after many, many observations, much and much data gathering over a period of maybe decades, a new fundamental paradigm or understanding about the physical world can arise. For example, the cell theory of life or the germ theory of disease. How did it come about? People made many, many observations of many, many types of living tissues and finally saw an underlying model or theory or paradigm. So in the same way, one takes the microscope of mindfulness, observes consciousness, and after many, many, many observations, a model or paradigm emerges, and usually over a period of many years and decades. We are talking about our subjective world. However, there's every reason to suppose that the objective world in some way parallels this process. An awful lot of modern physics seems to use language remarkably reminiscent to that used by the mindfulness meditators. Let me try to give you a tangible example of what it's like to see something coming out of nothing and returning to nothing. Let's say that you're sitting and meditating, and you become aware that you have a pain in your leg. You pay close attention to that pain in your leg, get a very clear sense of its shape, watch how its intensity may vary, let your awareness sort of float and circulate within it. And at some point, you notice that sensation begins to soften a little bit, become more like, let's say, a jellyfish. That means sort of puffing out here and then pulling in and then puffing out here and pulling in, almost like a two-dimensional surface that is waving in and out. And then as you penetrate more deeply into that, you realize that each time something sort of puffs up or wells up there, inside that welling up is small vibrations. So that the welling up is nothing but a whole bunch of tiny vibrations. And then when those vibrations die down, that region of the sensation subsides. You start to get this very clear perception of two scales of impermanence happening simultaneously. A stately undulatory movement, and then within each upwelling of an individual wave or undulation, a more rapid vibratory movement. As you pay even closer attention, you start to notice something that is pretty subtle. And that is that when that upwelling takes place, there are actually two oppositely directed forces. One pushing out and one pulling in. And they arise at exactly the same time and with more or less equal strength. And because of these oppositely directed forces, one at the core of that rising, pulling in, and one at the perimeter, pushing out, in between them is produced these vibrations. The vibrations come about because of the polarization of these two forces. You can experience this quite tangibly in something as common as your smile. when you smile, if you really pay attention to what it feels like, you can feel the muscles contracting, while at the same time the quality of smile pleasure is expanding and spreading. You can feel a contractive core in the smile and an expansive perimeter. You can also detect this in your breath. When you breathe in, at a superficial level, the chest expands. But while that expansion is taking place, the intercostal muscles and the diaphragm, they're all contracting, pulling inwards. If you really pay attention to both levels simultaneously in your breath, you can feel the expansion of your chest in terms of its volume, while all around there's a contraction in terms of the coloration of the muscles. And then when the chest collapses, you feel that the chest is contracting in the sense that it's collapsing, but it's expanding in the sense that all the muscles and the diaphragm and everything stretch. So you can actually feel those polarizations going on in ordinary experiences like the breath and your human smile. As you're observing the individual upwellings of sensation, the waves, you notice that inside the waves are wavelets. The reason that the wavelets arise is that there's a kind of polarization that takes place. Something pushes out, and at the same time, something pulls in. And that sort of vibrates these little waves into existence. And if you stay with that, you'll notice that at some point, the part that is pushing out isn't pushing out anymore. And the part that was pulling in isn't pulling in anymore. And it's like they commingle, the positive and the negative, the plus and the minus, the expansive and contractive, commingle and mutually cancel. And that's when the little wavelets die away. And in that cancellation is an experience of profoundly significant peace. And then you become aware that suddenly the forces are pulling apart again. Expansion is pushing out, contraction is pulling in. There's vibration in between, and another undulation of sensation comes into existence. But where did it come from? It came from the flat line breaking up, the canceled state of the universe, polarized into a contrast of expansion and contraction. And that significant, profound peace went away for a moment. That peace broke up. It broke up into something expanding, something contracting, vibrations in between. And then if you continue to observe, once again, the part that's pushing out stops pushing out, the part that's pulling in stops pulling in, the two come together, and there's another moment of earth-shaking tranquility, what in the Christian tradition is called the peace that passeth understanding. And you come to realize that each one of those waves of experience is just another cycle of this. And what happens to the sense of a material body experiencing pain in a location is that that goes away. And it is replaced by this rhythm of polarizing, vibrating, neutralizing peace, polarizing, vibrating, neutralizing peace, polarizing, vibrating, over and over again. And so what you get is an alternation of effortless effervescence. And in between each one of those upwellings, a moment of earth-shaking peace. And that's all that pain really was. But when that process is blocked, then it turns into this sense of a material body. In actuality, when you have this experience, there's always a little bit of a sense of a material body there. but you experience it arising inside the folds of those vibrations. So you realize, oh yeah, so that's where the sense of materiality comes from. It comes from the whatever part of this process is incomplete, leaves a little residue and gives us a sense of solid, opaque, separate matter, etc. And then you'll be drawn to some other part of your body and you'll realize, oh, the same thing's happening here. And then you'll be drawn to your whole body at once and you realize, wait a minute, if the sense of a body is arising this way here and the same way over here, well, obviously the sense of the whole body is just a whole lot of that happening everywhere. So now you actually literally get the sense that, oh, my body is being fermented into existence within the folds of this process. This zero is breaking up and vibrating, and the parts of the vibrations that are a little impeded or not caught produce whatever remnant of materiality I experience. The implication is that my ordinary sense of what is material must really be just this. When you start to meditate, you get the sense of you're a mind and body, you're sort of the background, and then within that background, you're having different experiences, meditating. But at some point, this figure ground reversal takes place. Your mind and body have now become a figure. And this field of impermanence becomes the background, and your identity shifts from being the mind and body, which is the product of that field, to being the field itself. For a period of time, you unbecome the product of the flow of impermanence. The product of the flow of impermanence is your mind and body and the material objects around you. You unbecome those products. And you re-identify with the activity that is producing them. That's a profound change in your fundamental perspective of things. As you are participating in this activity of the source, you are becoming the source. You are realizing you are the source. And you are realizing that you are not only your mind and body. You're the source of your mind and body, which of course is the source of all minds and all bodies and all conceivable universes. And then a sound will arise. And as you pay attention to the sound, you realize that the exact same thing happens there. There's a pulling apart of the positive and the negative, and there's a vibration, and that's what that sound is, that's what that wave of sound is. And a thought will arise, and you realize, oh yes, the thought is exactly the same. The thought spreads and it grips. It spreads an associational field, that's expansion. It grips your attention, that's contraction. Instead of experiencing it as scattering and gripping, you just experience it as a polarization of nature. And in between are just vibrations, and your preoccupation with what it means goes away because it all means the same thing. It all means everything. When you have complete thoughts, each thought contains all the meanings in the universe. That may seem strange, but since everything comes about through this polarization of expansion and contraction, any particular thing that you experience in these terms links to all things. The expansion and contraction in your thought is no different than the expansion and contraction that makes atoms vibrate or makes stars expand and contract as they burn different kinds of nuclear fuel. The evolution of a star is a sequence of expansions and contractions. As long as stars expand and contract, then you also will be expanding and contracting. Because you realize that you are this fundamental movement of the universe. So although your mind and body may pass away, you don't identify so much with that mind and body. you've had an actual experience of not only seeing that mind and body arising and the whole surrounding scene arising out of this effortless peristalsis of expansion and contraction. You've not only seen it, but you have become it. You have been it. You've participated in it over and over and over and over again. You realize that you are that. You become it. You internalize it. You say, to a certain extent, yes, I'm this individual and I have these thoughts and feelings and these goals and these bad habits and these desires and whatever. Yes, I'm this, but I'm also that, in a very real sense. As long as the fundamental forces of the universe act, and even after there are no stars, there will still be affirmation and negation. There will still be more or less of something, more or less of space. Because after all, space itself is, as we know, elastic, stretches, expands, and contracts, Einsteinian view. So as long as anything expands or contracts in this universe, including the whole universe itself, which of course is eternity, so as long as there is that cycling, as long as nothing polarizes and then neutralizes, as long as there are big bangs and big crunches, as long as matter and antimatter come out of nothing and return to nothing in pair production, as long as these forces are, so also are you, because you know that is not only where you come from, but that is what you are. A human child is born from two parents. They come together, and when they separate, a child is born physically on a physical plane. At first, it is child, but it's hugged by father, hugged by mother, hugged by father and mother at the same time. And by going through that process of making a relationship with father, making a relationship with mother, making a relationship with both at the same time, eventually that baby, that neonate, matures, grows up. And it grows up to finally becoming parent, no longer a child. It takes on the identity called parent. Our consciousness is born moment by moment. Our experience is born moment by moment from our cosmic parents, our father and mother, expansion and contraction. They come together, unite, in something that is neither father nor mother. Neither male nor female. You can't say this or that about it. It doesn't expand, it doesn't contract. It's not God, it's not the devil. It is true peace. And then that true peace breaks apart and vibrates because it has two sides. And we're born out of that. By born, I mean instant by instant, of course, a self arises. Turn your head, a new self is born. Listen to somebody talk, a new self is born. That self can either be born in one of two ways. It can either be born as an enlightened self or not. If it's born as a non-enlightened self, that's the usual self that people have. They think it's a thing. They don't even know it just came out of the source. People talk about wanting to be born again. It usually implies a one-shot deal. It's good to be born again in the Christian sense, the fundamentalist Christian sense. That's a good experience. But after you're born again, then you got to be born again and again and again and again. The problem is they got a self, it breaks up, they're born again as a Christian. Good. Now they got the Christian self. What's the next step? Unwilling to let that one die and be born again. And again and again, lacking true faith. They think they have faith. They have the tip of the iceberg of faith. It's okay. At least it's faith. That's good. They had one experience. of dissolving into the source and being born again. But that's not enlightenment. You got to do it over and over and over again. You have to live true faith. True faith is, in the Buddhist tradition, is described as riding the ox backwards. And what is the ox? Expansion and contraction, of course. You've probably heard of the ox herding pictures. Why backwards? Because you have to be willing to let go of your need to know. You have to be willing to let go of each new self so that you can go back to the source, once again become zero, and out of that zero, be born again as even a more evolved spiritual self over and over and over, hundreds of times a day, tens of thousands of times a year. In that process, one eventually matures to the point of becoming parent. The source is not something you look at in meditation. It's something that you say, yeah, to a certain extent, this is truly what I am. And that is a healthy and realizable immortality. The usual concept of immortality, my personal existence will go on forever. That seems extremely anti-natural to me, that anything like that could be. A more mature concept and a more realistic concept, a realizable concept of immortality, is there's a shift in what I call myself. And that new thing that I now, to a certain extent, know myself to be and to have always been, is not a thing. It's a doing. And it contains two halves, one called life and the other called death. Expansion and contraction, life and death. This, of course, is quite a change in one's sense of things, fundamental change in one's perspective. So one may start by having this experience just with one little sensation. But one quickly generalizes to realize that one's whole sense of self and seen, moment by moment, are likewise born inside a giant polarization. At any given moment, a giant splitting apart of expansive and contractive. At any given moment, if you really pay attention to the whole self and seen, the whole situation, you'll see that there's all this pushing out going on, creating the space around you. But there's some place that's also yanking in at the same time. All of this is arising in between. It's just like what you experience in the individual sensation, except much, much bigger. Much, much bigger. So complete experience comes about when ordinary experience shows its wave quality. That's halfway to complete experience. When something that was matter becomes energy, when something that was particle becomes wave, that's halfway to a complete experience. The other half is that you realize that why is it a wave? Why does it go up? Why does it go down? Why does it go to the right? Why does it go to the left? Why does it push out? Why does it pull in? Why does it get more? Why does it get less? Because there is simultaneously a presence of the two fundamental forces of the universe, the two fundamental principles, increase and decrease. They're right there. They're making that wave. And so you experience that wave arising in response to these forces. And then as you stay with it, you see that absolutely inevitably, in every single case, the forces come together. They neutralize. And in that zero that they produce is contained all the expansion and all the contraction of the universe. Although zero may seem bleak, inside that zero is all the positive and negative, so it's a very, very rich experience. You can get to zero, of course, just by ignoring things, but that's not a very rich experience. That's called nihilism. Nihil. It's interesting. Nihil was the medieval Christian term for the nothing that is divine, the divine nothing that can create all things. But in contemporary usage, nihilism, it's the very antithesis of the mystical nothing. You can get to nothing a lot of different ways. Nothing is path dependent. Depending on the path that you take to nothing, it is either bleak and a bummer, that's nihilism, or it's rich and vibrant. People are afraid of the Buddhist term nothing or emptiness, shunyata. But you don't have to be afraid of that. If you want to know what shunya feels like, what the mystical nothing feels like, is it feels like when you dribble a basketball, you know, that sort of vibrant quality, vibrant activity. That's what nothing feels like. Not only is it rich, it is pregnant with activity, pregnant with possibilities. Nothing is path-dependent. It depends on how you get there. If you get there by some paths, you call that nothing horrible. But if you get there by what we might call the path of simplification, you call that nothing God. What do I mean by the path of simplification? The complexity of experience is simplified through mindfulness to the simplicity of six senses. Experiences can be very, very complex, but they always break down into certain amount of certain kind of thought, certain amount of certain kind of feelings, certain amount of certain kind of seeing, etc., etc. In other words, the great complexity of experience can be divided into the simplicity of, we have six senses going on here. So the myriad, the 10,000 is reduced to the six. But that's not by any means the ultimate simplification. The six senses are further simplified by being experienced in terms of impermanence. But impermanence has all different kinds of guises. And at first you don't realize what is the fundamental characteristic of impermanence. But then the impermanence becomes simplified to a cycle. And you realize that they're really just two sides. There's expansion and contraction. Sometimes you're primarily aware of expanding. Sometimes you're primarily aware of contracting. Sometimes you're aware both are present at the same time. And in fact, if you look very carefully, whenever you're having an objectified experience, both are present at the same time, because you're being born as a newborn between father and mother who have just separated. And then there is the experience of neither expanding nor contracting, which is a oneness that contains everything but is zero, is a nothingness. And that's the ultimate simplification. Then you get into this cycle, the ultimate simplification of the one which is zero. Breaks into two and may produce a whole bunch of things, but you realize that no matter what sort of things arise between the two hands of God, you're still always embraced by both of your parents. And then you experience the parents coming back together again for a new state of absolute simplicity. And so a liberated person's day is peppered with thousands and thousands of moments of true peace, the rich peace of the source. Concerning this zero, there's a subtlety. In point of fact, you never experience zero. One never experiences emptiness. One never experiences the cancellation. Then, doesn't that contradict everything I just said? No, that's where the subtlety lies. In the actual moment of cancellation, there is no object, there is no self to know, there is no peace to know as an object. So there's no experience there. That is cessation, nirodha. However, in the next instant, there is the return of a self that looks back and sees not the actual nirvana, but forms an image of that moment of nirvana and says, oh, this is fulfillment, this is completeness, this is peace. But that's actually an illusion. That's an image of the moment of cancellation. And all that enlightenment is the ability to form an extremely clear perception of what happened just before there was any perception. And you get this clearer and clearer and clearer image of how the process works and what it feels like. But all of that image of how the process works, that watching of this activity of impermanence, and the wonderful, fulfilling, liberating feeling that goes with it, that's all just what it is, thought and feeling. Enlightenment is thought and feeling. Enlightenment's a kind of illusion, actually, in the sense that it's thought and feeling, a conditioned event. But as one's enlightenment deepens, the thoughts and feelings that constitute the enlightenment get clearer and clearer and clearer about that which is happening just before thought and feeling. And you know that that which happens just before thought and feeling is what you really are. So you don't identify with the enlightened thoughts, the wisdom thoughts. It's, say, a little hard to understand, but it's a very important point. The actual moment of cancellation is not experienced by anyone. Only its afterglow. But believe me, the afterglow is plenty satisfying. The way Sasaki Roshi puts it is, in his typical Zen way of talking, enigmatic, weird, he gets real emphatic. And he says, you must realize, inside zero there is no need to see, neither is there a need to be seen. That's what he's talking about. So, and then he'll say, like, the God that you see is a phantom. If anybody tells me they see God, I'll tell them, they're an idiot. What you see is the afterglow of God. That's all that we can ever see. But believe me, if your day is peppered with 1,000 afterglows, a formless union, you're quite satisfied with that. You can't really see the complete God. We've talked about many modes, many facets, many functions of impermanence. I'd like to end the talk with a personal story that may make tangible the uses of impermanence. This man that I've talked about so frequently, Joshu Sasaki Roshi, sometimes likes to get up in front of a group and he'll hit the dais that he's sitting on with his fan and he'll say, so, What are you going to do when the earthquake comes? He'll just pop out of nowhere like that. So, what are you going to do when the earthquake comes? You hit his fan. What you talking about? Things come up in life. And how do we describe it? I was blown away. I was crushed. I was shaken to the core. That's the earthquake. The earthquake's going to come. You may find yourself blown away. What's being blown away? Other than expansion, perhaps unrecognized as such. Blown away, and we scramble around to somehow establish a center. But maybe we don't have to. Maybe we can just expand and find security there.